So, Maria, did you enjoy your butter biscuit?
Yes.
You did. Okay, you're still half digesting that. When you hear the words Football Club Barcelona, you might think, with all their corruption, paying off referees, mismanagement, they're for the birds. But now, they really are for the birds. Because they've published a book, which ties in with what we're going to talk about in this podcast, about all the fauna that exists in the Camp Nou, in the Barcelona stadium. Mm-hmm. So the bats that are there at midnight, the birds that circle when they blow the full-time whistle around the centre circle and everything as well.
Vultures.
Not vultures, finches or doves or pigeons. Who knows what they are? Catalan birds. And this is going to be a very sensorial podcast today. That's why we're coming at you again from the Retiro Park with this ambient noise in the background. We have birds. We have people walking past. We had an old guy in a kind of pedal car minus a wife or a child to justify him being in there. And a kid who's playing football with his father, who 10 minutes ago fell to the ground clutching his leg like Cristiano Ronaldo, saying, I'm injured. So, but before we get to all of that, that'll be all part two stuff. But as I said, it's going to be sensorial, it's going to be aural, it's going to be focusing on the senses, what we can see, and also colour and these wonderful things. But before that, part one of the podcast, and speaking of the podcast, this is the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me on the park bench for a drink from a can and a brown bag is Maria.
Hello. I'm still here.
Very good. Did you know bird is also old-fashioned slang for a woman?
Unfortunately, I do, yes.
I could mention something about big birds from Sesame Street. You know what I'm referring to, but we're going to keep it out of the podcast for this episode. But no, before we get to that stuff in part two, let's talk about what we went to last week. It's actually quite relevant for what we're going to talk about. You can probably hear two old people talking very loudly. We went to a new museum. Madrid is a cultural hotspot. Lots of museums, really. Mm. But it's very rare you actually get to go to a new one. Mm-hmm. You could literally smell the varnish and the newness of this museum. And do you remember what it's called?
Fundación Massabeu, so it's a private collection.
It is a private collection, but now mm-hmm. it's in a permanent museum, which you can go and visit and see. So it's on display, which is a good thing. This is what permanent or private collections should be like. And speaking of museums, it's been in the news, actually. The Pope has been in the news for two reasons. One, someone has used an AI bot to put an anorak on him. And it looked pretty convincing, and he looked pretty good. But also, the Pope has allegedly given back an Elgin marble, which the British government haven't been able to do. So I've been talking about that with a few people, i.e. classes, about what museums should do. Should they give back their artifacts? Mm-hmm. So much we can talk about, really. But just touching that for a second, I think yes. Do you think yes?
What do you think?
Yes, you do. Great, that's covered. Okay, on to the next topic. Mm-hmm. So this was a great museum because literally there's paintings from all eras, from the 16th century up to the 19th century, showing Spain. And you made a very nice comment, actually. It's like, it's not just, it happens once in a while. it was not just typical things of Madrid, but very regional. So you could see things from Sevilla and Valencia. And here is where you can pick it up.
Yes, you could see things from those places, but it's more common to see things from the 19th century from Sevilla or Valencia and picking on, like, you know, costumes and traditions and outfits and all that. But it's not as common to have things from the north. So there was stuff from Asturias, there was stuff from, like, the Basque Country. And I thought that was quite nice because clearly, you know, that would have featured, but it's just not as common to see it or as popular, and yeah, I was pleasantly surprised.
You could see things of like Las Fallas from Valencia before tourists came to ruin it. You could see the markets of Sevilla, and there's a great painting from Sorolla. And here's the thing: in one sense, it's really interesting to see the day to day of these people in these paintings. But then there's a great Sorolla painting, and it is a great Sorolla painting because Sorolla only did great paintings. But there's a man who was filling his pipe with tobacco, and he was dressed in traditional dress. So I'm sure in some of the cases, certain things were staged, or there's a certain ideal of what the rural person from this particular era or region would have looked like, you know. It's the painter curating a rustic scene. But apart from that, I think there were genuinely a lot of truth, to say something pretentious, shining through, and a lot of realness. And for somebody, you know, you're Spanish, I'm not, but, you know, for you seeing some part of your country and your culture, and me seeing something of my quasi-adopted country, and kind of learning something, it's almost a historical document as well. It was amazing.
Yeah, I think so, because, as we said, it wasn't just, yeah, there was a little bit of, you know, paintings, for example, from like a French artist that was depicting a gypsy woman, and, you know, with a tambourine and things like that. And this was classed as realism, and that's the idea that French people got of Spanish people. So yeah, there was a little bit of that, which is what you normally see. But then, as you were saying, there were more just ordinary scenes, like country people eating.
I think bumpkin was the word you used last time.
No, it's just like, I don't want to say peasants, you know. they were like, some people that were working the fields, and they were just having a break and having like some food. So those sort of things, very real, very, you know, with their normal outfits for the time in there and the place. So, yeah, I just found all those things interesting, something new.
A special shout out to the two old women who wouldn't shut the...
Shout out, literally. Special shout out.
A big shout out, yeah, who followed us from floor to floor, reading out the label very loudly. And then, you know, to make it even worse, the people who are working in the museum were also talking very loudly. And
it's painful for you.
Because that's the thing. Because we're going to be talking about sounds in part two. Mm. And there's one thing on your app about walking through a museum. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't have that on your app of a Spanish museum, because literally everybody's talking at the top of their lungs. And you learn nothing, basically. So. But big shout out to them. It was a pleasure sharing a space with them. I think if I could go back in a quieter moment, I'd appreciate it a lot more. But I think it's an exciting space. I mentioned there's a Sorolla there, but it's not really great Masters of Spain, even though I do think there's a Goya there as well. And there's also that Catalan guy, Plaume or something. He's a...
The sculpture?
Yeah.
Jaume Plensa.
Yes. Plaume.
Well, mix of Jaume and Plensa, Plaume, yeah, close enough.
It's his new nickname. So it's
in
kind
the
of,
courtyard, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of contemporary and historic stuff as well. So definitely worth a look in, I think.
Yeah. No, it was really surprising that I didn't really
know. It's just a dog on the loose, I know.
He was trying to climb on you.
Oh, really? Didn't notice.
I was really surprised, and that party was nice. I mean, the building was nice. I think it's also nice when you go to a museum in the actual space. You know, it was not intrusive, but it was really nice. And there were a couple of, like, probably pretentious touches, like big cushions, you know, massive cushions to sit down and stuff like that. But the rest of it, I think it was like, it was unobtrusive, and it just helped you. If you didn't have the people talking, it would have been, very conducive to focusing on the art, no, and reflecting on the art.
Judging by the amount of people that were there, I think it's going to be a very popular museum.
I think everybody had sort of, it must have been in like somewhere advertised that it was opening. I believe it used to be in another neighborhood, but I think it must have been one of these collections that, you know, you either had to pay or it was like restricted the access. So, I never quite had the opportunity to go. And now, as you said, it was like really popular, and the fact that it's free also helps.
Well, one of my favorite paintings or painters was Dario de Argollos, who painted a street in Toledo, as well as other paintings in a little corner of the museum. So there, Argollos, you can look it up, dear listener, after the podcast. All right, let's move on, as always, gingerly to part two. Musical interlude coming in 3, 2, 1, go. Welcome back to part two. So, you might have heard of ASMR, weird people whispering into microphones for your sexual gratification. Well, this isn't it. This is not it. This is something different. Now, Maria, you can take it away.
Oh, well, I mean, I remember when I told you that I tried listening to that, you were like, that's just obscene. And I mean...
Tell me more. That's what I said to you. It's obscene. Tell me more.
No, but like you were really shocked, and I mean, it's not all creepy.
That's misrepresentation of what actually happened.
You were shocked that I listened to it. Not just shocked by the thing. But anyway, it was an obscene. It was just creepy. I don't know, because like the one that I listened to was supposed to be like a mother kind of like combing your hair or something, and you know, it's just
It's weird. It's kind of ASMR is.
Creepy is
one way, but it's also very specific things. It's always somebody either kind of whispering about it, if you don't know what it is, or you're hearing the sound of someone combing your hair or something like that.
It stresses me out.
It's a new trend, though, because like I've noticed even on YouTube, there could be playlists of songs from the 80s, and it's like you're driving on Santa Monica Boulevard on 27th of February, 1984, you know, and it kind of sets the scene. So it can work. Not with ASMR, it doesn't work there. It works with those YouTube playlists, and it also works in apps like the Cam app as well, and soundscapes. Now, there are certain things like pink noise and green noise and white noise and all that kind of stuff. That does absolutely nothing for you. What is it anyway? Can you tell us what it is?
The app?
No. The white noise and the pink noise and the green
noise. Oh, it's all the same to me. I don't know. It's just like... Yeah.
Static.
Yeah, probably. It's like... You know, when you couldn't quite... You know, when the TV... When you go... Like, snow is... We were like the analogic era. Before digital TVs. Do you remember this?
Are
you
too young for this? Okay. Yeah.
It's that kind of like noise that something is not tuned. I don't know. It works for some people. I've heard like people that have like... tinnitus. You know... It's somehow it helps them not hear that beep, constant beep. So obviously for some people it's therapeutic. I don't find it very relaxing.
Well, actually there's a TV presenter called Derek Mooney, who was big in the 2000s, and he has tinnitus, and he apparently listens to the radio every night, because if he doesn't have it on in the background, he can't go to sleep.
Yeah, I think it's a thing, and obviously I have some people, but I think with all the sounds and all the other sounds we're going to talk about, it just depends. I mean, some people find like rain relaxing, and other people just, you know, get stressed because they want to go to the toilet or something. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, trains, for example, some people find relaxing, but there are all sorts of soundscapes, and some of them, I was saying to you, I find a bit bizarre.
Well, it depends what kind of person you are as well, because if you're a visual person or an aural person, I don't know, because there is something called slow television where it's very popular, even on mainstream TV. I think in Norway they did one a few years ago where they showed just, they put a camera on a train, like a 5-hour train journey from one point in Norway to another point in Norway, and you just watched it as it ambled through the countryside. In other words, like just watching a fire burning. And people say it's very relaxing, and it could be philosophically a reaction to this hectic world. Because Now, since the pandemic, apparently 45% of British workers said they would actually prioritise family and free time more than work compared to prior to the pandemic. So there is
a...
That's from The Guardian. And, that's where I get all my information. And, you know, so I can kind of understand the TV thing, the slow TV thing. Hmm. I really kind of... I mean, I've never sat down to watch 5 hours of a Norwegian train, but I could tune into it. Genuinely. But the soundscapes, you played a few samples to me. Some of them are like cityscapes, and they have titles like Mexico City or Dublin. And there's a picture there. So the title does a lot of the legwork, I think, because it just sounds like any kind of generic cityscape you get from a generic, you know, stock sound website. If you're doing it, you know, for a documentary or for a video, you need some people on the street as a background noise. You download that, you know,
like the noise, background noise right now,
like this, you know. We could upload this without us talking and say it's Los Angeles 1974, right? And maybe that would work, and you're curating a mood and an atmosphere and everything else, and maybe that's artistic and creative as well. But, you know, I mean, it's kind of cool. I mean, I'm not knocking it completely.
It reminds me of, like, those playlists that you... Going back to the YouTube playlist that you showed me of, like, inspired by, I don't know, Hopper, for example. So, like...
Yeah, they're cool. They're cool, yeah.
And they work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but don't skip into the paintings.
Just wanted to say that.
Fair enough. But no, but you enjoy some of the sounds. Tell us more. Mm. You're the user. I'm just a spoofer. So tell us about your user experience and what's worked for you and maybe why.
Yeah, well, it's something that I toyed with getting it a few times, but and never thought it was quite worth it. But well, yeah, recently I wanted to have some help with relaxation, and I thought I could give that a go. And obviously the app has a lot of things like meditation and things like that. But the soundscapes, at first I thought like I wouldn't like it so much because, I don't know, we were talking about this the other day as well, about how there's something satisfying about songs and when, for example, the words of the song, the title of the song arrives and then you hear it, it's kind of like, it's complete. No, it's like it makes sense. Or when you're listening to a song, most of the time you're waiting for I don't know, like the chorus, and otherwise you get a bit stressed. So with this it was the same for me, because I thought, well, if there's not an end to it, then I don't think I'm gonna find it, you know, relaxing. So I was saying this to you, there are two types, and it's quite peculiar how your brain works, because I don't know, you're listening to rain, and then there are, I don't know, 20 types of rain, like rains of rain, heavy rain, and rain on this, rain on that. And they are different, actually. But yeah, I suppose because it's something that mimics reality, like you could really be lying in bed and you could be listening to the rain, then your brain is okay with it, like it's constantly, it doesn't change. It's okay, because it could be real.
It's relatable.
Yeah, it is relatable. And you have an experience of it happening before. I mean, you know, most people, I'm sure, have been in bed and have listened to rain or to a storm or things like that. But then you have other things, and I gave you the example of like walking in the snow, and it's quite nice, the crunching sort of sound. I don't know, there's something nice about it without it being creepy or anything like the other thing. But it's weird because you hear somebody walking and you're expecting them to get somewhere. So like at some point of hearing like those steps, you're going to hear like a door creaking or something, and somebody's going to walk in, or you're going to meet somebody.
It's really interesting because, first of all, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, to make a jump there, is built on repetition. So it's a very powerful, successful song or score or whatever, piece of music, composition, because it has that repetition and it plays with that repetition. So each, you know, note is kind of playing with what came before. And it would seem, perhaps, if I'm not reaching too far, that these are apps and the soundscapes are built on repetition, the repetition of the white noise, the repetition of those steps that never go anywhere. So that's the key maybe to their success, because a lot of people respond to that like they responded to Beethoven. However, You did pick on something else that we mentioned before when we talked about Magritte, is that our brains are trained for the next thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what he played with in his paintings, because if he showed something, and you play with the consequence of that, like he put the wrong label on something and etc. So what your brain is reacting to is that as well. So maybe most people's brains don't react to that. They don't have the Magritte brain, they have the Beethoven brain, but you have the Magritte brain. And that's why this is a hot take now completely, but
yeah.
This is why it's enjoyable to a point, but not ultimately satisfying for you.
I'm going to have to go and think about this. I don't feel I can give an answer right now.
Fair enough.
I think, well, maybe you're right. I don't know. I'm obsessed with rhythm, you know, that we've talked about that in the podcast before. But rhythm is also a constant beat. Like, so a constant beat that doesn't change, I find that satisfying too. And that's not going anywhere, but it's a rhythm. So for me, it's like, I think the commonality is that there is a rhythm. Yeah. And I found that satisfying in the sense that there was a rhythm to walking. Mm-hmm. But then somehow my brain was expecting to get somewhere. So it's not that I didn't find it satisfying, it's that it didn't work for me to go to sleep because I was alert. I was waiting for something to happen.
Now I understand. You have the dancer brain, because normally when you hear rhythm, you're dancing. So yeah. You're doing something to the rhythm.
Yeah, and it's very interesting as well, because there's also like a relaxation method that involves some African beats. And then it's like constantly like tun, 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 tun. And also you have to do like a certain number of, you know, breathing in and holding and breathing out. And it really helps with getting the rhythm of the breathing. But for me, I don't know, I would say probably my brain is like more musical. So when the breathing was over, I was still like going tun, tun, tun in my head, like singing the song. So, you know, it doesn't always like work for relaxation, but it can just still be nice. Or for relaxation, yes, but not to go to sleep, I don't know.
Okay, interesting. Now, I think we've exhausted the sounds, unless you have something else you want to say about it. Because we have pending the colors as well.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, just things like a tumble dryer, you know, I find annoying enough it's like you got a washing machine going off like when you're trying to sleep. So to purposely put a sound of a tumble dryer like in the app just doesn't do it for me, but maybe some people, you know, it brings good memories.
And whales, it's kind of sinister.
The whale, actually, many songs have talked about this, and, you know, there's a Spanish song I remember, like the whale song, or, you know, it's very poetic, no? The whole sound of like the whale, and very eerie, but it's also like the frequencies have been studied a lot and all this. Probably not for falling asleep.
Well, we might have mentioned this on a previous podcast episode, but the whale song, which is effectively its language, does change every 7 years.
Wow.
So
for each individual?
Yes. Or probably for a pod, because obviously it's how they communicate with each other. Mm. So within a family group or their group, it just kind of changes for all of them. So it's effectively like us learning our entire language every 7 years.
And then like you're out of the group if, you know, if you go away and then they change the language and then like they chuck you out.
Well, there's another thing. Well, there's something quite interesting. I think it was in the Jonathan Franzen book, isn't it? Or no, it wasn't. It was somewhere else. With Birdsong, birds have inbuilt in them a particular tune. And for whatever reason, if that gets disrupted, with each kid the bird has, so the kid, the grandkid, the great-grandkid, the bird will eventually go back to that original tune. So there.
Very nice.
Spitting facts at you. Okay, so colours. We went to... Well, we'll go... Ah, yeah, we'll do the colours in part three. Why not? All right.
Thank you.
And welcome to part three. So Casa Arabe, our usual haunt, had on the top floor what looked like an IKEA showroom, but on the bottom floor a whole section on Moroccan colours, their symbolism and their theory of colour as well, which was fascinating for us because of the content that was there. But also we did see in the Fundación Telefónica a few years ago at a Eurocentric perspective of that. I think even Isaac Newton wrote a book about it. Other people did, and they studied it from European 1600s to modern day cinema, the Matrix having a green tint, etc., and also how the colorization of sport has made sport more of a communal thing, so the World Cups and tennis and etc. So there's definitely things that I enjoyed from this Moroccan perspective, and we can talk about that as well. But you having more of a nous for Arabic culture, kick us off.
Then again, I haven't been in Europe, so...
I have been to Rabat, actually.
That's a bit, look how happy he is.
Yeah, the Moroccan capital. They did mention, actually, a building that I did go to as well. It's the mausoleum of Mohammed V, which is covered in gold, because all of the colours have a special significance. And then they go into the colour harmonies as well. And we were talking about this as well, because there are certain things that make... I mean, they're, like, in our culture, blue... In the English-speaking culture, blue is for something depressing, which doesn't exist in Spanish.
Mm-mm.
Why does that happen? Who knows?
I don't know, yeah. That would be interesting to find out.
It would be interesting to find out. In Ireland, green is a lucky colour. It's also a lucky colour in the Arabic world. Why? Who knows? Is there a connection there?
And hope for, well, at least in Spain.
Yeah. So now, what else can we say? Someone takes a photograph of a bird next to us.
The blue and the green.
The blue and the green. No, I was going to say, for example, I lost my train of thought. Yes, the sea. That's exactly it. Because for us, the sea is blue. Well, she has a Primark bark, so God bless her. Irish culture there, being supported. hope she finds Ryanair during the Easter break as well, and she'll have the whole thing. But that's in green, in Arabic culture, green represents the sea. And I was saying to you, like, that is something that's actually really interesting, because it makes complete sense, because the sea is green and it is blue, and we just said it's blue and they just said it's green, but you can kind of see where it comes from in a way that you can't see where other things come from, as in blue is depressing in English but it's not in other languages. You know, and speaking of blue, there's a really nice thing about the Hombres Azules, the Blue Men.
Yes.
So the Blue Men group in America are like a comedy group, but in Morocco there are guys who dyed their cotton blue, the colors ran and became part of their skin, and they became known as Blue Men, and even influenced some painters, European painters as well.
So
mad stuff there, but good stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like an extended tattoo.
That's it.
Yeah, but that would be interesting to see how it affects, like, the blood and stuff like that. But yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, some of the things we're more familiar with, perhaps. But as you were saying, there are others. For example, making that distinction between, like, blue and green, but then also, like, turquoise. Like, for us, I think I would put turquoise in, like, just a shade of... I don't know if green or blue, I always have an issue with that, but in between, maybe. But you wouldn't sort of, like, class it as a completely different color, maybe, I don't think.
No.
Just like a shade. And for them, they sort of thought of it as a completely different color that had a relevance.
And all the colors have a relevance. White is for marriages, but it's also for mourning. Blue, as you mentioned, was something that certain tribes used to wear, and it kind of bled into their skin. Gold was for a celebration, of course, you can say. Red was something luxurious as well. And yellow was something that men would typically wear, something fashionable. While green, as we mentioned, was for the sea. So green tiles would capture the essence of the sea, or suggest that in some way as well.
And also, I would say more or less the neutral color is actually the color of mud. That I don't want to bang on again about mud, but truly, you know, because of the architecture and the mountains and everything, it's kind of like the neutral color is that sort of beige. And for example, when he was talking about the harmonies, strange harmony that you pointed out as well, was like between warm and cold colors, which is something we don't usually do in the Western world. and it was like blue and orange.
Well, I did point out, though, that's actually Terry's chocolate orange colors.
You did, but I think that might be the only occurrence of, you know, blue and orange is not two colors that you usually put together, I would say, at least in the Western world. But there is like extremely popular, and yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's like theories for certain ceremonies as well. There's a cultural section, so color harmony in folklore, in mythology, mm-hmm. color harmony in certain celebrations, color harmony in hunting and things like that. So it has a huge significance as well. But it's good though, because as you mentioned in your book as well, the stuff of life, people, I mean, we do have certain associations with color. Nowadays, you know, you might wear a blue t-shirt and you don't really think about it. Maybe they don't think about it in Morocco either, but historically that they, you know, they have these kind of associations. And it can really stand out, as you mentioned, because the mud and the brown is a very neutral color. So there is also the red walls of Marrakesh, which are very eye-catching. You even have the green corridor as well of a certain part of Morocco where you have lots of green buildings, but also lots of greenery as well. So it's just this palette where bright colors can really stand out. But Moroccan or Arabic art is always very colorful as well, because you have, you know, you go to the south of Spain, you go to the Alhambra, it's there as well. So it's something that they defined. Some things later than I thought they would have defined, because the fez carpet seemed to be a 19th century invention, if I read the panels correctly. Regardless, they had a huge influence on Europe, and brought these techniques and ideas into Europe as well. So it was quite powerful, quite amazing. I mean, it's a simple exhibition in many ways, but quite informative and very illustrative, because they had relevant pictures of people just wearing these colors, so it was nice.
Yeah, I think it was, because it was a mixture of like people and places. It made sense. It was also in Arabic. And yeah, sometimes like simple is better, you know, so you don't need a lot of pretentious stuff. But it was informative, so.
Sometimes you just need 12 photographs of mud brick houses in a bookshop in Madrid, mm-hmm. and people will be happy. For those who don't know, that's a reference to an exhibition we organized relatively recently. All right then, well, usual stuff, find us on Instagram, social media, YouTube, and that's it. So from me saying good luck, goodbye, all that stuff.
Let me say bye.